Andrew Rybick. I work for the Scottish Funding Council. Very interested in what you had to say. From what you're saying, the conclusions that I'm drawing is that the expansion of the system in England has led to colleges kind of becoming struggling institutions, third-rate institutions of learning, where, you know, if you end up there as a student, your status and so on is affected by this, by the college's behavior as well, forced behavior to having to struggle to find additional resources and so on. I'd be interested to hear how you feel the Leech agenda, which has, you know, in the last few years come on the table, is trying to improve, or is it another scheme that just provides another difficulty for colleges now having to pair up with sector skills councils and having to approve their provision, or having that needs to be quality assured by now by those sector skills councils or sector skills academies that are emerging? And do you feel that leads to further fragmentation in the system, or is there any light at the end of the tunnel for the colleges really in England?
Can I answer that question in two ways? Firstly, to say a little bit about the strength and quality of further education colleges. My points of reference to difficulty were about the way in which colleges, some of them, were having to grow their higher education under conditions which weren't particularly favourable for that. So they had to be in dependent relationships with more powerful institutions who had awarding powers. They might even own the students, and they transferred the funding under different kinds of financial sets of conditions on the one hand. Now, if you were a college which said, I don't want to get into that, you would then be confronted with your mainstream work, which was getting money out of the Further Education Funding Council, which is now the Learning and Skills Council, which will cease business in 2010. And I'll come to what next in a minute. And what we've seen in further education, from when you had a further education sector of colleges, and then we had the bigger sector, which included the private providers of training joining the colleges, along with sixth forms, the funding of sixth form education in schools also coming under this new authority, the Learning and Skills Council. So while the sector division remained, the further education part of it extended. And colleges previously had their own sector, and now they find that they're in a much more open sector, which is competitive, and which originally was meant to be planned, but is now increasingly coming under what the English style demand-led funding, which is largely giving the responsibility and a public subsidy for that responsibility to employers to define their skills needs and to contract with colleges to deliver that function. So colleges have had to manage the change of funding regime, and the Learning and Skills Council, which is really an adjunct of the department. Whereas the Higher Education Funding Council is genuinely, there's a degree of distance. Okay, it's nothing like the old University Grants Committee, but there is a intelligent competence and capability about the Higher Education Funding Council such that it can mediate between powerful institutions, which are independent chartered ones, and a government department which wants to try and steer them and diversify them, but can't do it directly. It has to go through the third party or a funding council. Now, on the further education side, not only do colleges are in a vulnerable position because they don't own their qualifications, they don't award them, and their main mission is to be responsive, right? That is their main argument with government in terms of their ability to be funded. They're able to respond quickly to a whole variety of needs. Now, the argument is, you know, are those needs coherent? Do they add up to integration in the college curriculum? Do they add up to progression, articulation? Do they make sense? Should colleges be doing higher education? Or is that a result of opportunism? Because it's an additional funding stream and it's at a higher level of resource than the further education unit of resource. So I want to just to make clear that the conditions for colleges are demanding, but and within that territory you have a spectrum of what the government calls failing colleges, and they will be put into special measures. They get put in the naughty corner, and they will have the inspectors and a new governing body and a new principal put in place to sort them out. So they come under tight regulation and control at one end. And then you have at the other end institutions which self-define themselves as successful colleges. And you see the same groupings equivalent in the further education sector as the demarcations in the higher education sector. So a Russell group would translate into the 157 group. And you would see other expressions of hierarchy and degrees of independence and power. But arguably, in the further education sector, they are far more vulnerable to the direction of ministers and government departments. So the Learning and Skills Council basically was getting closer and closer to government and was a direct vehicle for government priorities. So the government could change the funding rules to say basic education is our priority from next year, rather than upper secondary qualifications of a vocational kind. And that shift in priority had to be managed by the college within that kind of time frame. So that's the first bit of the question. The second bit was...
It's about the Leech agenda and how that...
About the...
How Leech...
The Leech stuff. Review. Okay, for those of you who may not be in the world of what I call the skills starship, which is basically... an inquiry launched by Lord Leech and has become a dominant framework for government policy in terms of growing anything which is skills related. And the twist in that is a funding model which is meant to take power away from the suppliers and put it more and more in the hands of employers. But putting it in the hands of employers has to be sponsored by brokers and mediators, because employers have to be helped in understanding what their skills needs might be. And then they will, when they understand their skills needs, they will contract with the college, independently of the funding council, for public funds, which they would get in order to achieve an upgrading or a reskilling of their workforce. Now, that is another experiment. Demand-led funding has yet to seriously happen, but it's meant to be the dominant framework for the future. And it's meant also to come into higher education funding of high-level skills. So at present, we have... If you wanted to get some new numbers, if you're a university, it's very hard. There's no growth numbers, given the current crisis. But there is the opportunity to get co-funded higher education, where you get the employer putting in a private contribution and the funding council will match that in order for some kind of public-private configuration for higher-level work to happen. And that is part of an attempt to move to shift the terms of trade between the funding council and its institutions and employers who are able to express and lead demand for the kind of activity which they judge to be important for their short and medium-term future. It's unclear, it's incoherent. The Select Committee savaged the Leech agenda and the government response to it. So if you want a good read, the report of the Select Committee going back to January is... A tribute to the function of select committees, which sometimes get a bad press. But if you want to see some oppositional intelligent thinking in play, it's the one opportunity to read it in a script, and it's a good read. That's a long answer. I apologise.
Some more questions. I mean, can I just make a comment? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, in England that one talks about the lifelong learning sector rather than the FE sector as well in many parlances. And, you know, a reflection of the move to a demand-led system is that there's a private sector competition for
it's an open system.
For the funding. It's a completely open system, which, anyway, mustn't say too much. There are two people over here.
I'll keep my answer short next time, I promise.
I'm Richard Bolson. I'm General Secretary of the WEA, which is very much part of that lifelong learning sector. My question is, I mean, I find it very interesting what you're saying. You didn't say anything about the target that the Labour government introduced in 1997 to get 50% of the population under 30 to become graduates. And I wondered if you felt that that had any impact on the way in which things have developed over the last 10 to 12 years, not least because what you've described is a cut-price way of boosting some of those figures, arguably. And the second point that I'd make is, do you see... I mean, I accept that, you know, you're right to say that higher education students attending colleges of what they're now beginning to be called higher and further education, I mean, they're turning the titles around slightly, may be seen as poor relations to their peers who are in universities. But do you see colleges of higher or further education that are running part-time degree access to part-time degree courses, often in partnership with employers in the way that you were describing just a minute ago? Do you see any strengths to that in terms of the benefits to the individual and to the local community?
Thank you. Take the first question about the highly controversial target introduced in the year 2000 in England, whereby by next year, a participation level of 50% of those aged 18 to 30 will be achieved. Now, that's a very interesting algorithm in the first place, because it meant you didn't have a comparable figure. In other words, you changed the definition of a participation rate to achieve, and you didn't have any comparability previously to measure it against. So the whole data sets which you needed to construct that has to be realigned. But what's interesting about the 50% target is that there's two competing views about it. It goes down very badly as an argument which says it's crude, it's plucked out of the air, it's about driving expansion. The flagship foundation degree is one bit of engineering. The target is another. And it's constantly ridiculed. And, of course, it won't be achieved. And, therefore, as it sinks and recovered by government, it's always a source of being criticised. Now, there's a very interesting bit of writing by Howard Newby, ex-sociologist, ex-chief executive of the Economic and Social Research Council, ex-chief executive of the Funding Council for Higher Education. He was very influential in writing the 2003 white paper which introduced fees for full-time undergraduate students. Fees which were variable up to a maximum in England. But he also argues, drawing on sociological evidence and theory, sotto voce, that the 50% target is also about this. It's also about saturation theory. The argument is that if you have the majority of your advantage groups participating in higher education, that is a point of turn in relation to widening participation. In other words, the degree to which the advantages of widening participation are able to be mobilised by those who already have and are equipped to take take advantage of those opportunities. If you have saturation, then you move into another stage in terms of participation. The potentiality is there. And it shifts the argument away from, and this is the other argument which Howard Newby was suggesting, that it's a really important, you know, 50% is important, not just symbolically, but in terms of comparative sociology of stratification in higher education. There's a lot of work around the relationship, as I said, between growth, forms of stratification, and levels of equity and participation. And his argument is that 50% is a marker, and the need to get there, he would argue, was not ambitious. You know, he was always against the grain in saying that's not an ambitious target. Whereas, you know, it was being disputed as even a reachable target or a legitimate target. But underneath his argument was a view about reaching new communities for higher forms of learning, which previously would not be able to be accessed where you had existing opportunities disproportionately benefiting those who were able to take advantage of them. So if ever you want to track that argument, it's a very interesting one because it plays into the next stage of the argument is, well, okay, you can move to new universal access, but then you get into access to what? So it's what kinds of higher education for what kinds of student with what opportunities for transfer, and also what would be the social and economic outcomes, returns from the kinds of qualifications these new sets of students are able to take advantage of. But Newby argued that to get from one to the other, the 50% was more than something which was plucked out of the air. So I'm suggesting there's a bit of an underpinning, intellectual, economic and social argument to that particular target.
Hi there, David Lundy. I used to work in, as I mentioned to you before, in the quality assurance sector in widening participation in England. So this has been a reminder of some interesting and some disturbing memories of that work. But I was wondering, in your research, did you spend any time speaking to employers? Because you touched on the importance of collaboration with employers on foundation degrees. And certainly, in my experience, there were a lot of foundation degrees. The successful ones did have employer or professional body accreditations. And I think it's a status thing as well. I mean, part of the issue, I remember the institution I was working at, we got about 70% of our students through clearing, including some who we managed to convince to go into the foundation degree programs because they were of a lower entrance qualification, whereas there were competitor institutions which were, in one instance, had written to every person who had applied saying, if you attempted your A-levels, you have a place on our honours degree. And so there's an issue with the status, the saturation, as you were saying. And the status of foundation degrees, I think, really depends on employers. I was just wondering what work had been done with employers.
Not within our own research, but I would argue that employers are basically spoken for by the state. In other words, the government is acting as the proxy for the employer, with the exception of the large employers who both are investors, serious investors in training, and also their relationships to higher education are multi-stranded and important. But the Leech agenda has to be led by government and has to have an infrastructure of public money subsidising employer effort to judge their future skills requirements. And it's that way round. And it seems to me that you know, the history of the English and their relationship to, you know, the world of work and higher education has been that uneven relationship. And you do not see leadership from employers in relation to new forms of higher education. You have examples of employers in partnership with institutions genuinely developing and designing new forms of higher education. But they have to be a result of formal interventions where there are incentives and rewards to do that for public, for private sector employers. And of course, many foundation degrees aren't just playing in relation to the private sector. They're also being in alliance with public sector environments where, in a sense, there's an indirect public subsidy in the way in which those two, the employer, the public employer, and the higher education provider can come into relationship. I was exasperated and said, look, this is dysfunctional. This is not what I'm here for. And I would suggest it's not what you're here for. But, you know, there's a very interesting failure to debate anything which is outside of a government set of directives and grooves. But on the other hand, foundation degrees have been interesting. They're meant to substitute for other previous forms of short-cycle higher education. They've met their targets. It's about the one thing in government terms which has, they can claim a success. Partly that substitution, the old HNDs being recast as foundation degrees, but you're genuinely getting some new configurations and some with strong employer involvement and interesting employer involvement. But the architecture which has been created to achieve that in terms of new public-private outfits, sector skills councils and so on, regional development agencies, all having to come into partnership, huge transaction costs in order to generate a new course. I mean, the actual costs of launching a foundation degree are profound if you actually attempted to cost them in terms of the amount of partnership activity and traffic in negotiation which goes into them. So, you know, the actual achievement is reasonable and interesting, but the amount of government effort, to its credit, trying to move it is substantial.
Can I just come back on the status issue, though? I mean, if you have a situation where you can effectively, in some institutions, do a full-time honours degree or begin a full-time honours degree, whether you stand any chance or not of actually being able to complete it, with really no UCAS points, with very, you know, very few entry qualifications, how does the foundation degree compete with that? Because I mean, part of it is this location, a sort of further education context for people who maybe wouldn't want or wouldn't be suited to an honours degree.
Economists would answer your question by comparing the private rates of return for short cycle qualifications and bachelor qualifications. And it's still the case that your bachelor qualification, that the average rate of return is considerably higher. Now, the foundation degrees haven't got enough of a track record to begin to measure that significantly rigorously. But the consistent evidence seems to suggest that the rates of return for a short cycle qualification are broadly comparable with getting the equivalent of an A-level upper secondary qualification. The average rates of return. In other words, the bachelor degree is still offering, on average, a much higher level of potential return. But at the same time, the average is being stretched. So that average includes a high return from a certain kind of institution and a certain kind of degree. And at the other end, a rate of return for a bachelor degree may be the equivalent of a short cycle qualification. So rates of return are always problematic as a measure of output and impact. And I think they become increasingly difficult to measure, particularly because many of these short cycle forms of higher education are part-time. And those calculations just don't have the ability to actually capture that context and that trajectory of an individual.
Hi, I'm Bill Wardle. I've been a principal and deputy principal in FE and HE in Scotland and England. Can I just take you forward, Gareth, of a very interesting presentation and maybe where you wanted to go in terms of, I think, about having a dual sector and the consequences or identity crisis for institutions in this sort of unfettered situation. And it's a situation where you've already touched on, where institutions will take things into their own hands. And what's going into institutional hands in England at the moment is the creation of huge mega institutions, Manchester, Leeds. We might, in the next millennium, have one in Glasgow. It's taken 15 years to decide to have it in Glasgow, but it could happen. But what then creates is interesting statements of strategic intent by these institutions. So, faced with the questions, what are you going to do with this growth? Two of these major institutions, Newcastle, largest college in England, Jackie Fisher says, we want to be a polytechnic. Now, you know, that's a pre-92 statement. What does that mean? Or Michelle Sutton at Bradford, another huge one, says, we want to be a global university college. Now, that self-confusion is only to be added to, I think, by the government's statement, we're going to create 20 new university centres. So the rush of the 157 group to get there is presumably going to be pretty rapid. Yeah. So that's my first question, you know, where does it go? Second question is, okay, take a dual sector away and go back to a single sector approach. Might want to go there, might not. How do you do it? You can do it like the Scots do it, by calling ourselves a coherent system. And by calling it, we supposedly have it. But we have, as you say, I agree with you, absolutely, we have a dual sector. We have a flagship qualification, our HND, which is singularly college-based, but is exclusively, largely, not recognised by the ancient universities. We have a huge problem of articulation. Or you can go back to where the Australians have gone and say, OK, the Bradley Report in the last few months, we're going to go for a blank sheet of paper and we're going to change the funding regime. We're going to equalise funding. Major panic by the Australian equivalent of the Group of Eight, of the Russell Group, the Group of Eight, which they can see their research funding going away. But they are addressing issues of inclusion and of creating a parity of esteem for vocational colleges. So, you know, my questions are about what do you do when you've got a dual sector? You really have problems.
Okay. Can I answer it from the institutional context first? Because I'm struck by a secular trend. North America, Australasia, other examples of what you might call community college education in post-secondary systems around the world. Consistent examples of mission stretch. Take, you know, the quintessential example, the American Community College. Styled the two-year institution where you do your associate degree as the first part of a bachelor trajectory, which includes a four-year institution. It's a transfer function. What do you see? Lots of pressures and examples of the bachelor degree now being awarded in the community college context, partly as a result of local labour market requirements. For example, paraprofessions in nursing are mainly located in the community colleges. Hence, the credentialisation, the credentialing of that has an upward drift to it, and you see colleges playing to that. So the same debates you will find in Australia, in North America, and in England about the degree to which it isn't just drift, it's stretch. And what does that mean for strategic intent? What does it mean for coherence? Institutional coherence, the ability to manage that degree of diversity. In England, we have some colleges which have 14-year-olds in the college as a result of relationships with schools at one end, and you have postgraduate students at the other. And in the largest university I quoted in England, that is the case. Any candidates for which university that might be? It's the largest university, Thames Valley University, which 10 years ago merged with a large college of education.
Okay. The dual sector, you will get trading up by colleges. Your colleges will want to become polytechnics.
But sectors are there to prevent trading up. They're meant to control and contain aspiration. That's my point about the English system. Right.
There'll be an aspiration, and they will misalign themselves with a particular mission of whether it's a university or a policy. But the Thames Valley one, the reverse drift, went because it had to root itself into a quality environment that it couldn't guarantee because of its HE performance.
Okay.
Left to its own HE devices, Thames Valley would have gone out of business.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, I agree.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I know that caterers are going to come in and take things at four, so we're probably going to have to make that the last question and just ask you if you'd like to make some final remarks.
Okay. Only to thank you for listening and thank you for your questions. I have an email address on the project website, so if you wanted to inquire or read our stuff, I'd really welcome you to do that, and certainly to engage with us. I think my final point is the uncertainty about the direction of the English. The Learning and Skills Council will be abolished next year, and if you're a college, to get money for your 16 to 19 education, you'll go to local authorities. To get money for adults, but only skill-related adult work, you'll have to go to a new funding council called a Skills Funding Agency. And the conditions and machinery for that are yet unknown. And if you're a college, that is the kind of turbulence and uncertainty which is the routine nature of management and survival, I would suggest, in the English arrangement.
Well, thank you, Gareth. Just a few final remarks. I've sensed a significant interest in this topic, and I'm sure we'll return to the topic in further seminars in the future. Here in the faculty, not just in Cradle, but in other parts of the faculty, we've got a lot of interest in these issues, and we're currently involved in studies of the role of higher education and their regions, including studies of the role of community colleges in Illinois, university colleges in Flanders, and so on. And some of that we'll report at later stages. And I'd say to all of you, please just let us know the sorts of things that you want from us in other seminars. We have got some arranged already for next year. And this year, later, this is my advertising, on the 5th of June, I hope you come back, we've got John McKnight from Northwestern University in Chicago talking about asset-based community development. Some of you may have wanted to have come to a seminar which we had to cancel because of a bereavement from Joseph Convitz from the OECD. That's been rearranged for the 8th of October. I think we have Peter Mayo from University of Malta coming over, who some of you may know, and so on. And we'll keep you informed of all of that. But do feel free to email me or Alan Foster over there, who's just joined us as our research centre manager for Cradle and other things we're doing in the faculty. Now, just let me formally thank Gareth for a presentation which I think has been very stimulating, and I think it's been something that's allowed many of you to reflect on what's going on here in Scotland in relation to the role of FE, and I'm sure we'll be delighted to see you back at some future point, and we'll be reading the variety of publications that are no doubt going to come out of this TLRP project in the future. So once more, let's thank Gareth.